This is Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to exploring where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zach. I'm your host, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C.
On this episode of Reaganism, Roger sits down with Matthew Stegman, who is the chief revenue officer at Anduril Industries. They discuss Anduril's new products and initiatives, like their new autonomous naval system in partnership with HD Hyundai. They also discussed the war in the Middle East, Iran, and Ukraine.
Matt Stegman, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roger. Great to be here.
Now, you're, of course, the chief revenue officer of Anduril Industries. You're no stranger to defense and technology. Tell us just for a minute what a chief revenue officer does, or perhaps is that the hardest job at a new defense tech company like Anduril?
Yeah. First, for those who don't know, Anduril is a defense products company. We mainly focus on autonomous and AI-driven systems, robotics, things like that for U.S. governments and allies. Chief Revenue Officer, yeah, I see more and more of it these days. It's essentially the executive responsible for business development, program management, revenue delivery, meaning are we hitting cost schedule performance on our contracts? And generally being responsible for making sure that the growth of the company matches the financial forecasts that our investors expect.
And of course, Anduril is one of the top two or three examples of new defense tech companies, obviously privately held, but you know, really significant valuation with a B next to it, reportedly. And in the running for some really consequential, meaningful programs for the Department of Defense, as the Department of Defense looks to really take the era of autonomy and AI seriously and seriously integrate that into the force. We'll start with the most famous one, but then I want to back up into this idea of a company that builds products. And you guys emphasize that a lot. You emphasize that as you talked about your role as chief revenue officer, and we'll get to that very important word when you build products, scaling them, right? So let's start with the big Air Force program, big in terms of, I think, consequential impact, really moving to the next generation. That is Collaborative Combat Aircraft, CCA. Tell us about CCA, and Anduril is in this select group of, you know, four or five companies that the Air Force is looking at to deliver its future combat aircraft, autonomous combat aircraft.
Sure. So I think first off, this is what it looks like when government is working properly. So I think there's a reasonable shift in thinking towards autonomy and unmanned. And, you know, today, maybe the last 20 years, that focused a lot on smaller systems that are super effective and very important and frankly critical to Anduril's business. We build a lot of smaller systems that are AI and autonomously driven. This is taking that to the next level. So it's applying those same concepts, but to really a strategic level asset. So for the audience that isn't tracking so specifically, this conceptually is basically a bunch of unmanned friends that are flying in and around a manned fighter aircraft, doing all the things you could imagine, helping that aircraft sense and see and affect at greater distances and effectiveness. As sort of released a couple of months ago by the Air Force, Anduril is privileged to be one of the five companies that is sort of in the mix, trying to be, you know, the company that ultimately builds a lot of these very advanced machines. You know, I think maybe of note, we are the only non-traditional player in that field. The other four are, you know, the household names in defense that everybody knows. So it's a super exciting program. I think, you know, really at the end of the day, it's the Air Force really doing things the right way and demanding the best of their industry performers. And I think they're going to get the best out of it.
It is definitely exciting and different. One of the differences, Matt, is the numbers we're talking about here, right? I mean, and by numbers, I'm referring to two things: cost. It should be, I think, pennies on the dollar as it relates. If you compare it to, you know, a Joint Strike Fighter, you know, the fifth generation fighter the Air Force and the services have, and then numbers in terms of how many we want out there. Right, this should allow us to buy a lot. And whether you look at Ukraine, you look at Iran's attack on Israel, I mean, the future of warfare is clearly where you're going to be using drones that cost a lot less. And whether it's swarming or something like that, there are going to be many more out there than I think what we had contemplated in terms of use of force and conflict in the air a generation ago. Give me your take on those two items.
Yeah, you know, I think what's interesting is yes, of course, cost and scale are related. You need the budget in order to buy. What is not obvious is that, you know, let's say in a scary future that no one likes to imagine, you know, we are in a hot conflict with China. But, you know, we're the United States government. We've got all the money in the world when there's an actual war and threats are being made and we need to surge. And so, like, at the end of the day, it almost doesn't matter what the aircraft costs. What matters is your ability to actually manufacture them at scale. When you have an expensive aircraft, no matter how much money is available, there are reasons that you literally still can't manufacture them, because just having an expensive aircraft implies a lot of things about your supply chain and the exquisite parts that make up that vehicle, that if overnight the US government said, we have four times the budget, we want four times as many, they still won't be able to make them, right? It has nothing to do with cost. It literally has to do with the design that these companies take in their approach to building these exquisite systems. And so cost is important, yes, because yes, we need to be able to afford the scale and the mass that we want. But it's also important because about what that implies about the design of the aircraft in the first place, where at Anduril, we've taken the approach that if someday down the road, the US government comes to us and says, we need 4 or 5 or 10 times more than we actually thought, because of what that cost implies about our design, we will be able to rally the supply base in order to make a significant increase in our manufacturing capacity overnight.
That's a fascinating point. Really interesting, and of course, goes to the heart of what many inside the Beltway are fretting over as it relates to the defense industrial base. You know, one of the discussions that have come out of the war in Ukraine, and it's coming out of the Middle East also as it relates to Israel, is the need for production capacity for products that Anduril doesn't make, right? The traditional 20th century stuff, whether you talk about 155 rounds or other sorts of weapons like a javelin or a stinger, things like that. And again, to your point, aside from cost, there isn't the production capacity to get there. You have supply chain issues, at least as it relates to the autonomous AI-infused systems that Anduril is building, you know, the products you describe. How are you approaching in a fashion that you feel, hey, if I get the nod for let's do this 5X or 10X, whatever we're under contract to do, you know, you can look in the eye of the Secretary of the Air Force or the Secretary of Defense and say, got it, we can deliver that. What are you doing so differently that allows you to get there?
Yeah, you know, it's always a lot of things, right? There's never one thing you're doing in order to do something that complicated. You know, I would think that from just a company philosophy perspective, from the very start of a program, we are already thinking about the implications for how you manufacture, the choices that we make, things like having a financially driven engineering design process where at the very beginning, cost is a requirement to the program and what we're building. That seems quite obvious. I think a lot of your listeners are probably like shaking their head like, well, why wouldn't you do that, right? It's actually very unusual in aerospace and defense to start a program like that. So everything we do, you know, everything we do to pull design left, to pull experimentation left, to parallel process multiple parts of the system, to the digital threads that we create in true model-based systems engineering approaches. Like all of this, at the end of the day, has the same goal, which is the thing that we make. It's not just the first article. It's not just low rate production. It's can we make it at scale, and can we get to, you know, this concept of affordable mass that a lot of people say, but you know, maybe not a lot of people know how to get to.
Yeah, it's actually counterintuitive because you think, all right, if I'm going for a non-traditional, the risk is that they don't have the big manufacturing plants and warehouses that a traditional, of course, has, because they've been producing stuff for generations. Yet the argument I hear you making, Matt, is actually you're better positioned, you being Anduril, to deliver at scale and beyond even what the department thinks they need, because of this mindset and approach you're taking, which, as you say, isn't standard in the aerospace and defense sector. What else is out there? You referenced the beginning. You describe Anduril as you're making these AI and autonomous products, and I don't know if I'm just a passive LinkedIn observer. There seems to be a new product every couple of months coming out of Anduril. All right, put on your marketing cap and give us the top two or three big things coming out of Anduril that if folks aren't on LinkedIn, they may have missed.
Sure. Well, I mean, we should start with the news of this morning. The Australian government just announced that our autonomous underwater vehicle, which is called the Ghost Shark program, just got the nod that that's moving to production. That is a school bus size vehicle. It can be underwater at sea for a long, long amount of time at ranges that meet the requirements of operating within the Pacific. We are extremely excited and proud. And it's another example, much like the U.S. Air Force sort of is an exemplar in CCA. I think Ghost Shark, in terms of how government can partner with industry, is another one of those examples of when it works, and it works big and fast.
Explain that. You know, so what happened in Australia that was, you know, big and fast? And maybe even explain why you had to go to land down under to realize your undersea vehicle product. I know there was an acquisition involved there, but capture those items.
Yeah, I think it's risk taking on both sides, and the set of variables you need to come together. There's always a lot, you know, a dozen, two dozen sort of different stars need to align in the world to do something that is that ambitious. And the ambitious part of the Ghost Shark program was, can we get from, you know, basically a good idea, we had a smaller vehicle with the right architecture, to an ambitious, very large vehicle in 3 years' time. So design to production of three vehicles in 3 years. We are actually ahead of schedule and under budget on the program, which is even more kind of insane to think about when you think about how these traditional programs work.
That's a formulation you don't hear. Say it one more time. You're ahead of schedule, under budget.
Ahead of schedule, under budget. It's right. Pretty crazy. You know, kind of like a lot of the news came out, and that's certainly the headline. And it kind of misses the point that it's also just kind of one of the more badass military capabilities that we've produced as a set of allies in a long, long time. So I hope we'll kind of get past the shock of you know, ahead of schedule, under budget, and actually start to say like, oh my God, this thing's actually amazing in its own right, which we're quite proud of. You know, we talked about risk a little bit. I think another part of that program success is that we had skin in the game. So this was a co-development project where, yes, there was significant Australian dollars in the funding that we matched dollar for dollar. So, it was a highly risky endeavor. If it didn't work, we were going to lose a lot of our own dollars. And so when we talk about design and speed, everything aligns the government and the performer, if both take risk, to produce quickly and to produce at scale. And we're hoping to see much, much more of that alignment of financial incentives moving forward.
And you did this with Australia and the Australian Navy, not the U.S. and the U.S. Navy. Why?
You know, it's an alignment of champion-like thinking. I think the Australians didn't have a capability in this class. The U.S. program to develop this was, you know, sort of one of these classic, you know, a decade over the allocated time, you know, significantly over budget. And I think there was a set of champions in the Australian government, Minister of Defense, that said, okay, we're done waiting. China's at our shores. We are the first defense in the Pacific. We need to move. Let's take a risk. It's a calculated risk. You know, there was a lot of effort that went into making that calculation on theirs and frankly, our part. But when those things align and you have the right set of champions and you have a motivated engineering team, it's amazing how fast things can go.
Do you think the U.S. Navy is going to want this? A school bus size undersea vehicle?
I think it is an absolute no-brainer. I think it'll take some time, and there's always, you know, politics and programs and budgeting, and you have to step through all of that, and you can't just like snap your fingers in the U.S. government and make that all work. But what I have found, I've been doing sort of complex technology projects in government for about 20 years now, is that when the technology is really game-changing, it actually is a step function change in capability. You get through all of that stuff. You get through all of the hurdles and all of the barriers that we talk about all day long in various forums and on various panels. Those things seem to go away when the technology actually is game changing.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. You know, that's always been my intuition, right? If you really have something that's game changing, just a paradigm shift sort of capability, then at some point it's going to be so obvious you have to pursue it that all the red tape and the bureaucratic inertia is not going to be able to prevent it from breaking through. And to me, there's no better example of that. Maybe space. I'll put space aside because I think we've seen so much in space because there was nothing else, right? I mean, to compete with it, and certainly Elon Musk and SpaceX worked hard to get to that point. But the technology revealed itself that you really couldn't hold it back. I think autonomy. I mean, it's just, I mean, I think explained this to me, and my sense is it's the theory of the case for Android writ large, and it's going to play out, and it is playing out in every domain, right? And we start out talking about air, and now we're talking about the sea or undersea, as it were. And I expect we are seeing some of it already, land as well. We're with Matt Steckman, the Chief Revenue Officer of Anduril, and we're talking about their products, all of which are autonomous, but varied and different. The Deputy Secretary of Defense, we had her here not too long ago for our innovation-based summit. And in her remarks, it was interesting on innovation, Matt, she chose to talk about the industrial-based strategy. And manufacturing, oftentimes, if you talk about innovation, you're not really talking about the industrial base because you think you're kind of, well, the innovation is about the future, industrial base is how do we keep things chugging along from the 20th century. But I do think there's some wisdom there because we really need to have a modernized industrial base and manufacture things differently. Kind of we're hitting on that a little bit earlier. She did not talk about Replicator in her remarks, so I took the opportunity to engage with her during Q&A on Replicator. What's been Anduril's posture to the Replicator program? Again, this is small autonomous drone sort of project that the deputy secretary has taken on. She wanted to get in 18 to 24 months, multiple thousands of drones. And as she said on stage at the Reagan Institute, hey, if Ukraine can do this in a matter of months, certainly the United States can do it. Have you guys looked at it? And what's your perspective on Replicator, Matt?
I mean, we think it's awesome. I mean, talk about taking a big swing and using the office that you hold to really try and move the needle. Like, there actually are not a lot of needle-moving changes in defense technology that are made on a year-to-year, decade-by-decade basis. This is definitely one of them. And I'm a little unconventional when it comes to thinking about the industrial base. I think that if the government sets the conditions properly, the industrial base sort of like magically fixes itself. And what I mean by that is in the Replicator program, conceptually, The risk reward is aligned where if a company takes risk, they build their own product, they spend their own money to build these products. And I think in the new defense tech world, that is the mode, right? Spend my own money to make something, which I
That's sine
think is
qua non.
important to realize.
And there's coherence there across the board.
If I do it and I get rewarded with an at-scale buy, it creates sort of this virtuous cycle of investment and reward that you see in almost every other sector of the economy, except for defense, where in traditional defense, the government is the risk taker. They are bearing all of the costs for research and development. They are bearing all of the costs to scale. They're paying for manufacturing facilities. They're paying for production. They're paying for everything. They're even paying for obsolescence of parts in inventory. I mean, things that is you would just never see across the rest of industry. When you flip the script, when you tell industry, take risk, and if you do, I'm going to cut you a big check and I'm going to buy a lot of your things, industry will fix itself. It is actually not hard to build a manufacturing facility. What's hard is getting a forecastable business with the government such that you can make a CapEx decision to do the investment in the first place. And I think the bones of Replicator fix a lot of that.
Yeah, that is a very optimistic read of Replicator because it assumes one that A, they'll cut that big check in a, and their the department's definition of big is private sector definition of big, and two, embedded or at least I took your comments to suggest that it will be sustained, that this isn't some sort of one-off and this isn't a program of record. My sense, and I gotta expect your sense is okay. Success is where you have a program of record, the sort of thing where the department is going to commit to invest in this over a 5 year plus horizon year over year and bring it along. Those are facts, not yet in evidence, as far as I'm aware, and Replicator. One of the elements that I think is interesting about Replicator is it's a reaction to and recognition that at the tactical level, these sorts of small drones are going to be at the heart of the battlefield. In Ukraine recently, I mean, it was eye-opening to hear reports from the front lines of how alongside the 155 rounds are the first-person view drones. A lot in the past couple of weeks reporting in national media on this and the related emergence of companies, buying their products, kind of the parts from Amazon and building FPVs and thousands are being deployed in the battlefield, and because the Ukrainians are not getting support from the U.S. and are running out of ammo, this is all they have to counter the Russian assault. What is kind of Anduril's approach towards a battle in Ukraine? And I mean that both from learning as well as participating in any way, to the extent you could speak about it, would strike me that that might be an area that would be relevant to Anduril. At the same time, reporting recently suggests that U.S. companies, not Anduril mentioned, others have not been successful in delivering Ukraine the sorts of drones that can operate in the battlefield in Ukraine because they can't really penetrate through the electronic warfare that the Russians bring to bear. So essentially, the drones die. Give me your take on that, Matt.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. So, I think the most important thing that maybe isn't talked about enough is there are really, really important lessons to draw from the Ukrainian conflict, for sure. But we have to remember that the U.S. military in a conflict will not fight like the Ukrainian military. And so what lessons do apply? And I think probably many of your guests have spilled a lot of words on this stuff more professionally and in a better way than I can. But air superiority, kind of dead. Ubiquitous sensing definitely exists. Electromagnetic jamming and interference much more sophisticated than I think we understood prior to the conflict. Like all these things are teaching us that there's some things that are basically table stakes for any conflict of the future with near peer or peer competitor. The recent press about U.S. drones not being used, we should talk about that. So yes, for these FPV style drones, cheap, efficient, small munition, I don't think the U.S. has a great class of munition. And I understand the headlines that were made. But we have to remember those fly a very short distance and have a very, generally small effect. Useful if you could be strategic in your strikes, pick your targets, do a lot at once, things like that. I don't think the U.S. government, and let's say the Army and the Marine Corps that will bear the brunt of any sort of land conflict, will or will want to fight in the way that the Ukrainian land forces are. The important things to learn are what happens with sort of the weapons and systems that we believe we actually will need when you sort of figure out what the lessons we should and should not be drawing from the conflict are for the U.S. military.
Hey,
one
Matt,
thing that we believe
on that, though, I mean, I hear the argument you're making, and yeah, that's quite sound. We're not going to fight like Ukrainians, right? Presumably we will fund ourselves to fight in the way that we have not funded the Ukrainians. But the Russians are fighting that way too, right? But they're bringing their drones to the battle. I guess is the point I'm trying to convey.
They are and they aren't. So the Russians are using much more sophisticated drone systems than the Ukrainians, and I think that is the lesson. So how do I sense and defeat those systems? And that's a problem that our air defense business is very much working on. We're the current program of record for US SOCOM that deals a lot in that world. And then how do I create systems that have those similar types of effects? I think that one thing we've definitely learned and have integrated into all of our products is that you have to carry a lot more weight than you might otherwise expect, because you have to deal with communications issues, link issues, GPS issues, jamming, and other electronic warfare countermeasures that, really, sort of in the war on terror and what we saw there, it just didn't exist. And so the class of aircraft, the class of drone, they are becoming more sophisticated. They are becoming heavier. But it's something that the U.S. government is very good at implementing and using. And I think is a pretty big difference in terms of the observations you're seeing on the Ukrainian side.
Yeah, great points. Definitely think there's learning opportunity in terms of how the Russians are operating and the degree of sophistication they bring in terms of electronic warfare to the battlefield and the jamming and the like. Speaking to U.S. officials, either they had forgotten or they were just reminded that the Russians are very, very sophisticated on this front, leading in the world, frankly, in terms of air defense and electronic warfare. We're going to close out the conversation in just a minute here and go to our lightning round, where we ask our guests to share their favorite Reagan speech, book, and quote. So, Matt, we'll put you on the spot here in just a minute. But before we close out the conversation, give us one other product from the world of Anduril that folks may not be familiar with, but give us some insights what the future of warfare is and why Americans should feel better because Anduril has developed a product to lead on it.
Yeah, well, we've talked a lot about, offense, I think, over the course of this conversation. So let's talk about defense. So we believe we are making the most advanced air defense AI-driven system that exists in the world, period. And what's interesting about it is...
Come in with these, just you undersell.
Yeah, why not, right? Yeah. Go big. I think when we started the company... Certainly a theme was go big or go home. And I think a lot of us have embodied that throughout the way.
Power to you. I love it.
So, the system is Sophisticated in a lot of different ways, but I think of note, we are extremely pragmatic in our approach to these types of problems. And we know that no single type of sensor, no single type of effect, be it electronic or kinetic, is going to be 100% effective. And so what our AI does is it knits and weaves these sensors and effectors together into a mesh such that you actually, for the first time, can create automated defense in depth against all types of aerial threats, be them drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, things like that. We're extremely excited about it. I think given what just occurred over this past weekend, Iran fires 200 very different types of things at Israel. We are going to need some very sophisticated systems to sense and affect at great distances. And we're pretty excited and proud about the work we're doing on the defensive side of this.
I'm glad you raised Iran's recent attack on Israel and combination of cruise missiles and ballistic missiles and drones. One of the reporting threads that came out of that attack is, the success Israel and allies had in defending against it. And, the number that's out there in the press, 99% were taken out, only a couple broke through. And that is a tremendous accomplishment for Israel's layered air defense set of programs and an approach air defense, of course, and for the U.S. and reportedly the U.K. and France and Jordan, perhaps others, also supported the defense. Matt, that whole kind of layer defense system that was employed really been developed over the past 30, 40 years. I mean, we're here at the Reagan Institute, so it starts with the Strategic Defense Initiative, right? And you have different systems for Israel, from the Arrow system to David Sling, all the way down to Iron Dome. And then you have U.S. fighter aircraft taking out drones along with some others. But you're talking about something different. So help our viewers and listeners understand what Anduril is doing and how it's kind of using AI to think about this problem perhaps differently than what we saw on display very successfully recently out of Israel.
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces here. I think, maybe the important piece is what we saw over the weekend was the technology that exists today, both from an offensive side and from a defensive side. And that offensive piece was relatively unsophisticated in terms of the types of things that Iran put into the air. And the Israeli defense is relatively sophisticated in terms of its response. But let's remember how many people were involved in that response and how many countries. Something that is very, very difficult to duplicate all over the world, where the U.S. has to project power. You don't have thousands of people and multiple countries ready to respond. Our systems focus on both what is the next offensive threat, because these things, as we're seeing in Ukraine, are changing day to day. When we do something, the enemy reacts, and so on and so forth. We believe that the only thing that matters in the air defense game is the velocity of change, meaning how fast can I keep up with the threat and what they're doing to counter my countermeasures. That fundamentally is an AI-driven problem, because at some scale, the human mind cannot process the threat environment fast enough to make the decisions about how to affect and how to defend. And that's the type of stuff we're working on.
Matt, let's go to our lightning round. Excellent conversation, really very clearly explaining complicated stuff. Grateful for your time. Here's where we ask our guests to share their favorite Reagan book, speech, and quote. We'll take all three, two, or just one, whatever you got.
Oh, man. How about I go with one of them? I think Reagan said something like, status quo is Latin for the mess we're in, or something along those lines, which is one of my favorites. The only reason I always think about it is it's like, I think he said it 40 years ago or something like that. And it's like, man, that's probably true today. I think a lot of the conversation we've had is about the status quo and how to change it. And it's actually quite hard. And, you know, I think recognizing that 40 years ago probably means it'll always be hard. But that's what we're here to do at Anduril, and we're excited about it.
Matt Stegman, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Reaganism. New episodes premiere weekly every Monday on YouTube and all podcast streaming platforms. If you like this episode, be sure to let us know and share with a friend.